After 20 years of value, valor, and sacrifice, it's time to bring those troops home.
The United States begins Afghanistan withdrawal. It's Monday, May 3rd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, more Australia-China tension, a COVID vaccine distribution debate, COVID affecting births, a lunar explorer remembered, helping hands from robots. It's all on today's VOA Asia. After 20 years, the final U.S. drawdown of troops from Afghanistan has begun, marking a watershed moment for both countries. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain joins us with more.
Pentagon officials say the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan is now underway, with some equipment being packed up and shipped out. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged serious security concerns, but says U.S. troops cannot remain in Afghanistan indefinitely.
We degraded the terrorist threat of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and after 20 years of value, valor, and sacrifice, it's time to bring those troops home.
The State Department has sought to reassure Afghans that the United States remains committed to the country.
The only military presence that will remain in Afghanistan is the very limited presence required to protect our embassy. And that's important for the reason I was just discussing. Even as we disengage militarily from 20 years of military involvement in Afghanistan, our presence on the ground will remain through our embassy, through our civilian representatives, including our diplomats.
The drawdown reminds some analysts of the last U.S. troops leaving Vietnam in 1973, a watershed moment for both countries.
I think there must be many Afghans, particularly Afghans in urban Kabul, particularly women professionals in Kabul, who do to a degree believe that the United States has made certain commitments and now it's cutting and running. It's a very difficult moment for U.S. foreign policy, as was our departure from Vietnam.
Other experts point out that when it comes to assigning responsibility for failing to help Afghanistan become a secure, flourishing democracy, there is plenty of blame to go around.
This is a long and significant investment that has not paid off, but others in the region have also not brought about peace in Afghanistan. To the contrary, they have continued to play a variety of other games. Afghans' own political leaders have not come together in unity or found a means to negotiate peacefully with one another in ways that would bring about a stable country.
Many Afghan women say they dread a possible return to power of the Taliban once foreign troops are gone, and say they will fight to hold on to their hard-won rights. When the Taliban ruled Afghanistan in the late 1990s, women were barred from participation in public society, including going to school and work outside the home. And some women were executed for alleged adultery. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
This story is developing. We invite you to read more by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia, also on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as Instagram. And we invite you to stop by our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Thousands rally against Myanmar junta, calling for spring revolution. Myanmar journalists living in fear as junta curbs freedoms. Pakistan tightens border controls to curb import of new coronavirus variants. Modi's ruling party loses crucial Indian state election. China's central bank works with Ant and Tencent to develop digital currency. You'll find much more on these stories with videos, text, and photos when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. There's much more VOA Asia on the way. Right now, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says multi-billion-dollar investments in military bases in northern Australia are designed to enhance regional peace rather than a deliberate response to China's growing assertiveness. In response, officials in Beijing have called Australian politicians the real troublemakers. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Australia is beefing up its military bases in the Northern Territory, including facilities to train Aboriginal recruits and others that host joint exercises with US Marines stationed in the region. Speaking at the Robertson Army Barracks in the Northern Territory, Prime Minister Scott Morrison insisted a 10-year, $6 billion plan to improve defence facilities was meant to keep the peace in an uncertain region rather than preparing for conflict. He was responding to questions from the media about recent tensions with Beijing over Taiwan.
All of our objectives here through the activities of our defence forces are designed to pursue peace. That is the objective of our government.
Morrison denied huge investment in military bases in northern Australia was aimed at sending a message to China. Government ministers and analysts have said Chinese military expansion in the South China Sea and its crushing of democratic dissent in Hong Kong have been of great strategic concern to Canberra. Morrison has also, though, defended comments by Australia's new Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, who said the possibility of conflict with China over Taiwan shouldn't be discounted. Dutton's remarks have further inflamed diplomatic tensions between Canberra and Beijing, already strained by geopolitical and trade disputes. Chinese Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesman Zhao Lian Wednesday called Australia's politicians the real troublemakers and declared Australia's concerns about the threat posed by China as unethical. Beijing has in the past accused Australia of peddling anti-China hysteria. Bilateral ties are now so bad that it's reported that Australian government ministers have for months been unable to speak with their Chinese counterparts who refused to take their calls. Caitlin Byrne, the director of the Griffith Asia Institute at Griffith University, argues that a more measured and delicate approach is needed.
I think not just cautious and careful diplomatic language, but also, you know, sometimes we need to potentially work quietly and less with a megaphone.
Australia has had to juggle commitments to a long-standing military alliance with the United States, with valuable commercial ties with China, its biggest trading partner. Political squabbles with Beijing have had damaging economic consequences. Canberra's call last year for a worldwide investigation into the origins of COVID-19 that was first detected in China caused fury in Beijing. There followed sweeping tariffs and restrictions on a range of Australian exports to China, including wine, beef and coal. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, a flash mob protest has taken place in Yangon as demonstrators continue to oppose the return of Myanmar's military rule. Protesters took to the streets despite heavy rain, chanting and carrying a banner. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's nice to have you with us today as we begin a brand new week together on VOA Asia. Amid a surge of COVID-19 cases in India and other parts of the world, the Biden administration remains noncommittal on a proposal to loosen patent restrictions so that countries can manufacture generic versions of coronavirus vaccines. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikaswara has this report.
Desperate Indians wait in line for vaccinations as the country's coronavirus crisis deepens, with the daily death toll climbing above 3,600.
We are surging oxygen all over India, all over Delhi, to Chandigarh, Ludhiana, Haridwar, Jaipur, and all our nearby cities.
In October 2020, at the World Trade Organization, India and South Africa proposed the so-called TRIPS waiver, which would allow countries to make generic versions of the vaccine. The proposal continues to languish without backing from the European Union and the United States. 100 million Americans have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But speaking on board Air Force One on Friday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said President Joe Biden still has not decided on vaccine patent waivers.
Our overall objective is to provide as much supply to the global community and do that in a cost-effective manner.
Waiver proponents, including the progressive wing of Biden's Democratic Party and humanitarian organizations, say that it could be a game changer in the global fight against the pandemic.
I think TRIPS waiver is one of the critical tools that can empower government to address the current situation of scarcity of supply.
But the administration is also under pressure from pharmaceutical companies who say that rather than waiving patents, the quickest way to help countries in need is by accelerating existing production lines and donating doses. An intellectual property waiver would not help accelerate COVID-19 vaccine access or address the very real supply chain and logistical constraints, an industry spokesperson told VOA. Even Bill Gates, the billionaire philanthropist and driving force behind COVAX, the UN mechanism to improve low- and middle-income countries' access to vaccines, is against waiving patents.
It makes very little sense. And this is a mistake on his part. And sometimes we should listen to billionaires when it comes to things like global health, but sometimes we really shouldn't. And this is one where we don't want to listen.
To reduce global vaccine inequity, Gates is instead pushing for technology transfer, where the private sector invests in new manufacturing capacity and shares know-how with emerging economies. He spoke at the Munich Security Conference in February.
Part of the way to solve that inequity is to get factories in India up in full speed. That's already happening with AstraZeneca. It'll happen with two of the others. And to get the financing.
The proposal to waive vaccine patent is supported by more than 80 WTO members, 60 former heads of states, and 100 Nobel Prize winners. It will again be in focus at the WTO General Council meeting on May 5th. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. An activist group in South Korea said it released balloons into North Korea carrying dollar bills and leaflets denouncing the government in Pyongyang, despite a recently imposed law that bans such releases in the South. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. A new study published in the Lancet Medical Journal finds that stillbirths, maternal deaths, and ectopic pregnancies rose during the coronavirus pandemic, possibly because women had reduced access to medical services. We have more with VOA's Mariama Diallo on the data covering 6 million pregnant women in nearly 20 countries.
Little Malek was born at the beginning of March. His mother, Hind Shurgen, found out she was pregnant during the coronavirus pandemic. She was told to minimize trips to doctors or hospitals where services were stretched by the number of patients with the virus. Eventually, she fell sick and was diagnosed remotely with pneumonia. But after her illness, her doctor did an antigen test that confirmed she's had COVID-19.
It's just a huge, you know, world that's really unknown, and it really pushed me over the edge, and I was so stressed out throughout the whole end of my pregnancy because of that. You know, what if, what if, what if?
After several scans, Shurgen was assured her baby was developing normally, but she couldn't stop worrying.
You're kind of, you know, playing a lottery with this information. I didn't get tested again for antigens, but I did carry out the fear with me and this worry and constant, like second guessing everything I did.
Professor Asma Khalil, an obstetrician at St. George's Hospital in London, is among a group of doctors studying the impact of the virus on women and their pregnancies.
We included more than 6 million pregnant women from 40 studies from 17 countries. And we compared the pregnancy outcomes during the COVID-19 pandemic with the period before the pandemic.
The report published in the Lancet Medical Journal found that the number of stillbirths and the number of women who died during pregnancy rose by nearly a third during the pandemic. The number of women who needed emergency care for ectopic pregnancies, where the fetus is growing outside of the womb, was 6 times higher in 2020 than the year before. Also in the report, a significant increase in the number of women suffering stress and anxiety. Khalil says stillbirths and deaths are not a direct cause of infection from COVID-19, but from what she describes as collateral damage of the pandemic. Across the world, lockdowns prevented women from traveling to hospitals for checkups. Co-author of the Lancet report, Professor Shakila Tangaratnam from the University of Birmingham, advises some caution over the data.
If you look at stillbirths, the figures are a bit more, but because of the rarity of the condition of stillbirths, the proportion itself is still quite low. We are talking about number of stillbirths around 1,000 in high-income settings, another 1,000 in a low-income setting. And again, this is something that will need to be reviewed constantly.
She says there is no doubt the pandemic has had an adverse influence on women's health, but many more studies need to be done.
How much it is? How generalizable this is across countries as well as across the income status? What are the specific factors that contribute most? So these are information that we still need to continue to report and collect.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, relatives of the 53 Indonesian Navy crew members who died in a sunken submarine paid tribute at a ceremony at sea. The German-built submarine was discovered broken in pieces at a depth of nearly 840 meters. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, NASA astronaut Michael Collins, who made history as part of the 1969 Apollo 11 crew to first land a person on the moon, died late last week at the age of 90. In interviews with VOA's Kane Faribault, Collins reflected on the importance of the mission and the contributions of the astronauts of his era, while keeping a focus on the future of crewed spaceflight and exploration.
Well, I was in this group here.
Yeah,
somewhere.
There you are.
Michael Collins grew up with his sights set on the stars. But he joked the one he actually orbited, Earth's moon, wasn't the destination of his dreams.
I'm a Martian. I think Mars is the next great destination.
While he never set foot on Mars, nor the moon, Collins made history as part of NASA's groundbreaking corps of astronauts selected for the Apollo missions of the 1960s and 1970s. He was the fourth human to conduct a spacewalk during the Gemini program, but it's his role as the Columbia Command Module pilot during the 1969 Apollo 11 mission, when astronauts landed on the moon for the first time, that he is remembered for most. His job was to pilot the spacecraft, orbiting the moon alone while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin explored the surface. After a rendezvous, they all returned safely to Earth. Collins credited the thousands of workers on the ground at NASA for the historic achievement of their mission and the overall success of the Apollo program.
It was a wonderful example of organization within a large government agency. That's something we don't see too much of today.
After traveling around the world celebrating the Apollo 11 mission, he retired from NASA. While working at the U.S. State Department, Collins was tapped to be a liaison for NASA to the White House during the 1970 Apollo 13 crisis.
Houston, we've had a problem.
He updated President Richard Nixon on the status of getting the crippled spacecraft safely back to Earth.
And he wanted really somebody to tell him yes or no.
The answer was yes, and Collins believed Apollo 13, known as NASA's successful failure, was a turning point for American interest in crewed spaceflight.
It made NASA and the American public more aware of some of the hazards involved in flying to the moon and back, and I think it focused attention.
Collins wrote about his life as an Air Force test pilot and his missions into space and the moon in a 1974 book titled Carrying the Fire. In interviews with VOA, Collins preferred to look ahead rather than behind, and he said there was a lack of momentum and urgency in accomplishing new goals in space.
Astronauts and former astronauts, we're very pro-space, so I'm pro-accelerating the exploration of space.
Collins believed the planet that inspired him as a child, Mars, the subject of his 1990 book, Mission to Mars, should be NASA's ultimate focus.
My friend Neil Armstrong thought that going back to the moon was a proper and necessary precursor to a Mars expedition. I'd like to bypass that, if possible.
While he did not live long enough to see someone reach the surface of Mars or a return to the moon, NASA's Perseverance rover and Ingenuity helicopter on the surface of the red planet today are charting new frontiers in space exploration that have reinvigorated public interest.
I think we're on our way, perhaps more slowly than people would like, but nonetheless, we're on our way.
Astronauts are again aiming for the moon as part of NASA's Artemis program, which plans to have crews back exactly where Collins once orbited in the next several years. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
The Apollo moon missions provided many technological advances that continue to evolve and help our world today. A robotic hand designed to help people handle dirty and dangerous jobs is just one example of automation that's benefiting humankind. VOA's Julie Tabo lends her hand to tell us more.
Robotic hands are nothing new, but the human-like hand this British company has been perfecting for 20 years is different, says managing director Rich Walker.
You can get a robot to do things with a gripper or a claw, but it's hard. So we thought, build a human-like hand, and that will make life as easy as possible for the robot.
The idea behind the dexterous hand, as it's called, is to free people from doing unpleasant jobs, says Walker.
Now, that might be a dangerous job, it might be a dirty job, it might just be a job that's difficult to do physically because of location, but if you can put a robot there with our hands on it, then you can control it to do the task.
Having the robot work remotely and controlling it with the gloves took place in 2019.
You put the gloves on, you make the robot move, and so as you move your hand, the robot hand does the same movement. You immediately see what you're doing, and people have just turned around and said, and I work in pharmaceutical manufacturing, and I could use this so that we didn't contaminate products. Or they say, I work in nuclear engineering, and we could use this so that we don't take radiation dosages, or we're not at risk of that.
Some of the gloves provide a sense of touch.
It's called haptics, and that will let you, when the robot touches something, feel it with your fingertips.
Experts say it's no wonder people are embracing this kind of automation.
Who wants a really unsafe job? Who wants a really, really dirty job? I would say probably no one.
Koenig says people should expect more human-machine partnerships going forward.
It'll help save lives. It will improve our experiences and free us up to do other things that are maybe more important to us. These are all use cases that are emerging today and will become more frequent in the future.
Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Our program today may be coming to a conclusion, but you can continue online. Visit us on our various platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Just look us up under our name, VOA Asia, and be sure to join us again at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.